I think it is just so important to walk into a room, to sit down, not stand up, and to talk to people. If you do that, the answer is there. It's not in the damn computer. The answer is in the room. And if you take the time, and I don't have many rules, but one rule, I try to never talk to a patient standing up. I go out, I get a chair, I pull it in, I sit down, and I have a conversation. And even if it's a 90-second conversation, I am showing them by sitting down that they are what's important to me right now. And I am telling them that I will take the time to listen.
Hey everyone, my name is Bassam Zaid and welcome to episode 21 of the Dr. Hustle podcast, where it's my privilege to interview researchers, creators, entrepreneurs, and leaders in healthcare and medicine. I dig into their habits, techniques, and strategies for these high achievers so that we can learn how they make a difference and apply it to our own lives. Today's guest is a legend in critical care and trauma surgery. Dr. Thomas Galea is the physician in chief of the renowned R. Adams Cowley Shock Trauma Center in Baltimore, Maryland, which is the only freestanding trauma hospital in the country. He has had extensive senior management experience, previously serving as a chief of trauma and critical care at Kings County Hospital, as well as serving as the founding chairman of the Department of Emergency Medicine at SUNY Brooklyn. Throughout his career, he has conducted extensive research in critical care and trauma surgery, established the Lung Rescue Unit, one of the busiest ECMO departments in the country, and has served as president of multiple trauma societies simultaneously. For full disclosure, I rotated at Shock Trauma last August. What I learned and witnessed was that even beyond the administrative duties of running a hospital, Dr. Scalia, also known as the boss, still works clinically, still performs surgeries, and still takes call despite being nearly 70. It's his lead by example, no-nonsense approach that makes Shock Trauma the powerhouse institution that it is. We had an awesome conversation about his life, how technology has affected patient care, and what it means to be a leader. I hope you enjoy, and without further ado, here's Dr. Thomas Scalia. So, Dr. Scalia, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start early in your life. Your mother, Anne Scalia, you've spoken about her having an important impact on you, and you've gone so far into creating a professorship in trauma in her name. Can you talk to us about the impact she's had on you as a person?
Sure. My mom lived to be 99 and a half years old. She died just about 8 months ago, and her death was the worst thing I've ever lived through. I grew up in a very traditional Italian family. Other than the fact that my father left when I was a kid, very, very unusual for the early to mid 1960s. And mom raised five kids by herself. She was a tiny woman, but incredibly powerful in every way. And her mantra was, you do for others before you do for yourself. I think she said that to me 10,000 times when I was a kid. It was her way of living and became our way. She was a very demanding woman. She didn't demand that we be the best, but she demanded that we do our best. That was true in every aspect of it. And anything that I have ever achieved, I owe to my mom.
Was it your work ethic? Is it your character? Or are you just basically across? Do you feel like you just took everything from her?
I took as much from her as I could get my hands on. And I was not the best kid. There were times when she should have given up on me, but she didn't. And there were times I wanted to give up on me and she wouldn't let me. And she was an enormous influence and role model for who it is I've become.
And so kind of what lessons have you drawn from her as not only being the physician in chief at Shock Trauma, but also still you're taking call, you're still an educator. So what lessons have you taken for her on basically how you kind of either set an example or teach your trainees?
My mom was a school teacher. She was a huge believer in education. And I try to use that as my example. She was really kind. She did not tolerate meanness or pettiness in any way, shape, or form. And I try to remember that. I don't do as well as she did, but I do my best. And she was a great champion for the underdog. She would always do a wonderful job of putting herself in somebody else's shoes. And I try to remember to do that. And so I live my life in a way that I hope makes her proud.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she sounds like a really amazing woman. Speaking of underdogs, though, on some level, did you consider yourself an underdog? Part of your history is that you were working, you grew up working in a factory.
Yeah, the factory. I finished college in January. That was 6 months too late, not 6 months too early. And I need a job. So I went to work in a factory. I worked from the time I was 10 years old. My brothers and I had a long mowing company, I guess you would call it, right? We had 25 or 30 lawns we cut, so 4 or 5 a day, 7 days a week. We were always looking for a way to make some money. We didn't have any, and so I put myself through college, paid for everything other than, actually I got no financial aid, so I ended up taking some loans out and just paying for everything. So work ethic was a real part of who we were. When I finished college, I went to work in a factory because that was the job I got. Mm-hmm. And I intended to go to graduate school, and that didn't work out. I ended up going to medical.
Which is also an interesting story in itself, because you've spoken about it being a dare.
Well, I never intended to go to medical school. I got bitten with the bug of experimental psychology. I met this guy who was a professor at UVA, and he said, well, you come, you'll be in my lab. And I said, great. So I intended to go to graduate school in Charlottesville. I applied to medical school on a dare because one of my friends said, I bet you can't get in. I said, I bet I can. I took the MCAT, frankly, badly hungover, and actually still did okay. And I applied to medical school for that reason. I applied to maybe 4 medical schools that applied very widely. I applied to the Medical College of Virginia. I got an interview. I sent my application in late. I got an interview on the last day of interviews. I drove down that morning, borrowed my girlfriend's car, drove to Richmond. It snowed. I got there late. I walked in late. And the first interview I had was with the dean of admission named Miles Hench. And Dr. Hench was the only person that interviewed me not across the desk. He had this table, little table and 2 chairs in his office that completely sit. And the first question he asked me was, please tell me about something that's important. And I talked about my family. Mm-hmm. I went through the day, and I drove back home. And I remember telling my girlfriend that they're the only people that have any idea of who I am. Nobody once asked me to solve a biochemistry question, or mm-hmm. they asked me questions about me. They wanted to know who I was. And so I said, I'm not going, but they're the only people that know anything about me. And then they took me. And then in the middle of the summer, I got rejected from graduate school. So I called the guy up who was on sabbatical and said, remember me? And he said, oh, yeah, things changed. I guess I should have called and told him. Mm. So I had the option of continuing to work in the factory or go to medical school. medical school seemed like a better idea than working in the factory.
Outside of it being a dare, did you love medicine at all?
No.
No.
Not at all.
This was just
as a matter of fact, I told my mother the day I left to go to college, I have no idea of what I'm going to do, but I know what I'm not going to do, and I'm not going to do.
So outside of it being like a practical move, maybe it's part of your, you know, I just got to get to work, and this is just part of my work ethos. At what point did you say, you know, I think I can be great at this?
I had a great desire to serve, to do for others, as my mother taught. Mm-hmm. Medicine was, that's sort of an easy choice then, right? To do for others. And so I went to medical school searching for a sort of a reason or a way to serve. And I didn't find it. I didn't like anything. Or I liked them all about the same. Mm-hmm. And so when it came to apply for a residency spot, I had no idea of what I was going to do until August of my fourth year. And I went to do a rotation in the medical ICU. And there was this guy named Barry Fowler. Barry is still Alpha Allsbury Fowler. If you Google the early work on ARDS, you'll find him all over that. And he was my chief resident. We were on 24, which was really meant we were on 30 and off 18. And we did a month like that of every other night. And I loved it. And I mostly loved it because I loved him. I said, I want to be like that guy. And so I said, well, that must mean I want to be an intern. So I said, internal medicine, that's what mm-hmm. I'm going to do. And I applied, but it was too late, right? It's now September. So I applied to maybe three or four medicine programs. And back then, there was still one or two rotating interns, like the old internships where you do a month of OB. Mm-hmm. And I applied to a couple of those. And I didn't match in medicine. I matched at one of those rotating internships. And so that's what I did.
And this internship was in surgery?
And I was in Syracuse.
Okay.
And so I did that intending to go to finish in internal medicine. And they tried to make me into a primary care doctor. And I hated it. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, I wasn't smart enough to say, well, if I just persist in medicine, I can do critical care. So I said, well, I must not want to do medicine. So I looked around for something else to do. Didn't like pediatric, didn't like OB, loved psychiatry actually when I was a medical school student. But I had this, I was in a adolescent psych rotation, and I really found my niche, and I was running the groups, and I became very close to a couple of kids, and I said, oh, I've really connected with them. And then one night they eloped, and it broke my heart. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't want to feel like that. Mm-hmm. So I said, I wasn't smart enough. I don't want to feel that way. I'm not going to do psychiatry. And I picked surgery because that was the thing that was left.
Your story is so interesting because I'm trying to find lessons to be learned from someone who's very accomplished. And it seems like you seem to roll with the punches, if anything.
I think the lesson here is you kind of go where life takes. And to me, I always, every decision I make, when I went to surgery, the first rotation I did was transplant. And I met this guy. I still have his picture over on the shelf in my office, Richard Burleson. And he was the chief of transplant. And I wanted to be him. So I decided I was going to be a transplant. And I would have done transplant, but he had the bad taste to get lung cancer and die when I was a chief resident. I just mm-hmm. wanted to be with him. And so I have tried all my life to be that guy. I try to be the guy that people say, oh, I want to be like that. Mm-hmm. And try to inspire people and make them see kind of why doing this is a good thing to do, you know, particularly now when doctoring in many ways is so much harder.
Yeah. Can you talk about that more?
Well, it's, you know, the regulatory stuff is stifling and the ability to be creative is much harder, and you can't write for this antibiotic without papal dispensation, and it's a very much more confining career than it was when I was a kid, and so, but it's still a wonderful thing to do. Some days are better than others, but still a wonderful thing to do.
Right. So, in terms of mentorship, a lot of times people aren't lucky to have those people on a rotation with them necessarily, or all of a sudden become, you know, they're attending. So do you have any advice on how people can find those mentors?
Yeah, I think they're there if you look for them. I don't know how you go find them, but I think you keep your options very much open. I think that you look for somebody that inspires you. You look for somebody who has courage and is willing to stand up for what's right and is willing to ask the hard questions and is willing to do. There are more than a few of those people around. They're disguised a little bit more now maybe than they used to be, but they're still around.
The other thing I'm curious about is, you know, you fell into surgery. It seems like growing up that you also like to work with your hands. Did that, was that any kind of appeal to you? I mean, the fact that you like to do things with your hands, or?
Not really. I wasn't.
No.
I wasn't very good at any of that stuff. All of my siblings are A, incredibly bright, and they're all artists. Oh, you know, one's a musician, one's a painter, one speaks four languages, the other a great writer and communicator. And that's what I wanted to be. I think the coolest thing is to create, right? When you write music or you draw, you take nothing and you make something. And I think that's the greatest thing. The problem was I was no good at it. I mean, on a really, really, really good day, I was a medium bad musician. And so I couldn't do any of those. So I interpreted this as healing. And so my art, I decided, would be to heal. And it's not quite the same because it's not taking nothing and making something, but it's taking something and making it better. And that's how I got to it.
I mean, I think that's a really great way to look at it. And I imagine surgery, out of all of them, would be the most artistic because, and maybe it might be the least confining and most creative, because the regulatory committee can't be in there while you're in a surgery to tell you, no, don't do it that way.
It's a fair characterization. Taking care of really sick people, which is sort of what drew me to all of this. When I was a resident, I just found myself in the ICU. And I didn't finish in surgery so much because I liked operating, but I liked taking care of sick people. And back then, the sickest people were the surgery bay. Creating solutions in the ICU, manipulating physiology, I found that fascinating. And so that's what took me in this direction. Trauma was, frankly, along for the ride, right? Because you do trauma when you do critical care. And so it came as a pattern. And that's how the trauma part happened.
Yes, that's really interesting. So let's kind of talk about where you work, shock trauma. It's renowned, yet I feel like still lots of people don't know about it. So can you tell us about what makes shock trauma so unique?
It's the only freestanding trauma hospital in the United States. We care for upwards of 8,000 trauma patients a year, and we do that because of the unique Maryland pre-hospital system, which is a pyramid, and we sit at the top of the pyramid. So the most critically ill and injured patients end up with us. Dr. Cowley, it's his vision, right? And he's the guy that created the term the golden hour and recognized that injury is this time-sensitive disease. And that time starts ticking when you get hurt, not when you get to the hospital. So we created this pre-hospital care system to deliver people to the most appropriate level of care as quickly as they possibly can. The overlapping ground and helicopter transport. An average trauma service is maybe 40 patients, I would guess, at your shop. The trauma service, which is probably lumped with acute care surgery, maybe has 40 patients on it. We have 160 beds. Mm-hmm. So it's its own little, not so little city.
And do you think it's because of the Maryland EMS system that makes this possible? Like, why can't this be duplicated in other places if it's been so effective?
It can't be duplicated because of money and policy. This got created when nobody cared about trauma. As a matter of fact, they told Dr. Cowley, you want that junk? Have at it. Mm-hmm. There was no competition. The other part of Maryland is it's exactly the right size. It's not a very big state. It's got about 6 million people. Baltimore's in the center. So you can get there by air, over the mountains, over the water. But if I went to some other place and said, I want all the trauma patients, the competing hospitals would say, you can't have our stuff. Mm-hmm. And the money to set the system up would be prohibitive. Now, Maryland is the only state in the union that I know of where the citizens contribute to trauma care. So $13 on everybody's vehicular registration fee goes to support trauma care, most principally MIMS, right? The Maryland Institute mm-hmm. for Emergency Medical Services System, and the helicopter transport. That's unequaled anywhere. And if you go around Maryland, people would be shocked at that. They think they own this, and they do, mm-hmm. right? They believe if they are lying on the street, they have the right to hear the helicopter, and they have the right to land on my roof.
Wow. And so you have dual roles there. Not only, you know, do you still take call as a trauma surgeon, still round in the ICU, but one of your roles is also physician in chief.
It is.
What is physician in chief? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, it just makes me responsible for the shop, right? And I have interpreted that broadly. It's a little bit of a University of Maryland, a little bit of a complicated administrative place, but if you go up to the housekeeper and say, who do you work for? They say, I work for Dr. Delay. Mm-hmm. And I know every one of them. I can't say I know every nurse because there are many of them, but I recognize every nurse, and they are very familiar with me walking the hospital at 3 a.m. mm-hmm. or 3 p.m. and so these are my people. This is my shop. This is my responsibility. I am the face of the Shock Trauma Center, and it's a responsibility I take very, very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And what's a typical day like for you?
Yeah, I get here between 6 and 7 if I got to go home the night before. I usually take a quick look around, just kind of take the place's temperature. You know, are we running 5 emergencies? Is the resuscitation unit on fire? Mm-hmm. I will then, if I'm operating, which I do many days, that'll start around 7:30. I make rounds. Afternoons, I'll have some meetings often, or I'll have some more clinical responsibilities. And then I make my real set of rounds early in the evening. And I do that because things have settled down. The administrators are out the door. Nobody's calling me for at 6 p.m. for a meeting. And we can leisurely walk around. Back before COVID, that's when the families would be there. So I would be able to run into people's families and chat them up. And there's no rush. It's a very, the rounds can take an hour, hour and a half. And we'll just go around, and it's my time with my team, right? Mm-hmm. I will go and we'll talk about a disease. We'll talk about we'll look at some scans. We'll make some plans. We'll talk philosophy. We'll talk kind of whatever it is that's on their mind that day. And that'll take, until 7:30. And then I'll sit in the office for a while and, you know, do the administrative part of it. And then I would leave at 8:30 or so.
Mm-hmm. You also have a nickname, The Boss. I'm totally curious where this comes from.
That was given to me.
Yeah.
Mostly by my faculty and the nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got here, I was young, right? I was 45. I had a ponytail. I was Tom. I was Tom to the nurses. I was Tom to the faculty. I was Tom to everybody. And then as the image grew and I got old and the ponytail went away,
mm-hmm.
that many of the younger people wouldn't call me by my first name, which kind of crazy because the nurses who had been there for a while all call me by my first name. But the younger nurses and the faculty didn't. And it was a little uncomfortable and too formal for it to be Dr. Scalia.
Mm-hmm.
And so they picked Boss. Hey, Boss. because it was informal enough to reflect our relationship, but it wasn't my first name.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. The other thing that's unique about Shock Trauma is that it's in Baltimore, which is known for its gun violence. And it's, you know, I guess you'd say appropriate for a trauma center to be there. And I know you've written op-eds before about, you know, the devastating impact, you know, this gun violence has in the community. So has this at all influenced your feelings or thoughts on gun or firearm regulation?
No.
Mm-hmm.
I was against guns before I moved to Baltimore. I'm really against guns now.
Uh-huh.
I understand people believe they have the right to bear arms. And okay. I just don't see why somebody in the city of Baltimore has to have a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see, you know, what I always say is, if you eliminate drunk driving and distracted driving and all of the preventable causes of vehicular crashes, you will still have vehicular crashes, right? Mm-hmm. There's human error. People drift off to sleep at night while they're driving. There is industrial real accidents. There is never a reason why a person has to pick up a gun and shoot somebody.
Mm-hmm.
It's completely preventable and unnecessary.
And in terms of the firearms that you, or the firearm injuries that you do see, is it, you know, basic handguns? Are you seeing like military grade or, you know?
Well, we see a few military grade, mm-hmm. but not many.
Mm-hmm.
We see a lot of handguns.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of handguns in both.
You work basically over 100 hours a week. What kind of system do you have to stay productive without burning out? Like, how do you keep yourself organized?
That's a good question. I have more trouble now with COVID because before COVID, Stevie, who is this wonderful woman that just runs my life, She built an hour in every day for exercise. And the gym is literally across the street from my office. Mm-hmm. So even in between cases, I would build an hour. If I walk out of the operating room as the bandage is going on, and I run across the street, and I get dressed, and I work out for about 55 minutes and take a shower, I can walk back into the operating room for the next case and be exactly on time. Mm-hmm. And so I found that incredibly helpful to clear my mind.
And what kind of exercise would you do?
I lift mm-hmm. one day, I do aerobics the next day, and I alternated. Mm-hmm. That was great. And it just freed my mind. Mm-hmm. I'm also, I'm just an organized person. You know, you laugh, right? Because people say if you want something done, you give it to the busiest person because mm-hmm. they know how to get stuff done. And that's kind of me. I do not waste 30 seconds in a day. If I have 2 minutes in my mind, I have my 2 minute list, my 5 minute list, my 30 mm-hmm. minute mm-hmm. list. And if I have 2 minutes, the next thing up on my 2 minute list gets done.
Mm-hmm. But basically it sounds like you have lists. I mean, that's part of the system in your mind. You never write anything down.
Never. Oh, wow.
All right. That's really amazing. Speaking of COVID, you have spoken about the importance of touch in medicine.
I have.
And so I'm kind of wondering, how have you had to adapt with COVID?
Yeah, COVID's terrible in every way.
I know, it's the worst.
It's particularly terrible to get it, which I did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was terrible. Uh-huh. It has limited our ability to interact provider to provider, provider to patient, person to person in every way, shape, and form. And I, of all of the things that has been terrible about COVID, I think that has been the worst. The inability to touch other people and patients, just anybody. I think it's made us less human. It's made us understandably more scared. Mm-hmm. And it's fundamentally changed the way we interact. And all of those changes are bad. None of them are.
It's also accelerating how we interact with technology. And you've also spoken about how there's like the technology creep into patient care, which understandably, you know, a lot of people are not fans of because it's no longer, you're not rounding around the patient anymore, you're rounding around the computer. And as this accelerates it more, I mean, how would you advise the next generation, especially the newest generation, you know, that's coming up, that's only ever known technology, how to adapt their actual medical practice around this? Like, how do you...
The next generation doesn't want my advice.
They don't? Let's just say they did.
They've got their way of doing it, and uh-huh. so be it. You know, uh-huh. That's how they will do it, the way your generation will do it, the way your generation mm-hmm. is going to do it, and it doesn't want to do it the way my generation. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I think it is just so important to walk into a room, to sit down, not stand up, and to talk to them. If you do that, the answer is there. Mm-hmm. It's not in the damn computer. Mm-hmm. The answer is in the room. Mm-hmm. And if you take the time, and I don't have many rules, but one rule, I try to never talk to a patient standing up. I go out, I get a chair, I pull it in, I sit down, and I have a conversation. And even if it's a 90-second I am showing them by sitting down that they are what's important to me right now. And I am telling them that I will take the time to listen. I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. When you do that, you learn a huge amount about the patient, not only just what's the matter with them, but who they are and why it is that they maybe made this decision, which seems kind of odd. To me, that's one of the most important parts of doctoring, is to know what's going on with the patient. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that might actually work with your trainees as well? Or is it a different kind of leadership style? Or I guess you're not leading with a patient.
Well, I think I am who I am, right? Mm-hmm. While they're on my service, my trainees are forced to do it my way because that's the way we're going to do it. They're welcome to take those lessons with them. And they're welcome to say, it's not my style. I don't want to mm-hmm. do it then. I have no authority to tell them how they should live their life or how they should practice their craft. Mm-hmm. I would like to think that they would see at least some advantages in what I do and or how I do it and will adapt some of those lessons to how they do. Of course, once they leave, I have no idea of what they're doing.
So. Right. So I guess, in your opinion, what makes a great leader?
I think a great leader leads from the front. And every time we do something new, I'm the first person. Mm-hmm. When we're going to go do a new project, when we took over an ICU down the street, I was the first person to go work. Mm-hmm. And that's always been the way I have been. It's always going to be the way that I am. It's very odd to me that people run things and don't work nights. How the hell do you know what's going on if you're not there? Mm-hmm. How do you know what they're going through if you're not there going through it with? And I just don't get it.
So I guess part of that is I wonder, kind of related to your system of organization, the fact that you work so much, how do you also balance, you know, work and family? How do you keep the peace everywhere, you know?
I don't know that I do keep peace. I know that I am at peace with who I am or how I do things. But, you know, there was, I was just rereading my AASP presidential address from 6 years ago. And I remember quoting Deb Stein, one of my favorite people, who's looked at me one day and said, it's hard to have work-life balance when you have no life. Mm-hmm. And okay, fair enough. I'm okay with that. I have had so many opportunities. And I will tell you one quick story. But around 2000, I'd been at work, I don't know, two or three nights. I was just dog tired. I'm getting ready to leave at 7 o'clock. I'm changing clothes. There's a knock on my door. And I open it up. And there's this short Italian guy that I'd seen around. And he said, my name's Osvaldo Chiara. I have an appointment. And I opened my mouth to say, I can't talk to you because I'm too tired. And I heard my mother getting ready to hit me in the back of the head for being impolite to this visitor. Mm-hmm. So I said, come on in. Would you like some coffee? Because if I don't have a cup of coffee, I'm going to fall over. I said, yes, thank you. I made some coffee. Well, it turned out Osvaldo was Professor Chiara. And Professor Chiara had autopsy data on everybody that had died in Milan of injury for the last 2 years. Starts getting interesting now, right? Mm-hmm. Because we talked for hours about it. And the cute story about the coffee is at the end, I look, he has a touch of coffee. And I said, is there something wrong with it? And he looked at me and said, for the first time, but not the last time, this is not coffee. This is dirty water.
Hey.
He was expecting espresso.
Yeah.
And so he and I wrote what became a landmark paper, because 43% of the deaths in Milan were either potentially or definitely preventable. Hmm. And for writing that paper, he was dismissed from the university, but he wouldn't go away. And they ultimately, one of the politicians gave him part of a hospital in Niguarda, and he put together the first organized trauma service in Milan. Wow. And he shockingly patterned it after ours. Mm-hmm. So he just dropped a small version of shock trauma into it. And I helped him do this a little bit. Well, this has now exploded, and there is a real trauma system in the north of Italy. And I go over until COVID. Every December, I go over and do a conference with all my staff, get Christmas presents from Milan every year, and thousands of people have lived that would have died. And that's all because I didn't tell them to go away. And so you look at that and you go, I look at that and go, there's another victory for lousy work-life balance. Because I got an opportunity I wouldn't have had.
But I mean, that's also, I guess, part of being open to opportunity too.
Yeah.
Which I think is another thing that's kind of defined your life, because on some level, every time you rolled with the punches or you didn't get something that you didn't want to, you're still open to the next step instead of being kind of stubborn at any one point and being like, no, I.
Yeah. I like to think, that's who I am. Yeah. Maybe it's not true, but I'd like to think it's true. And I've been very lucky because I have been given, maybe when they arrived, they weren't great opportunities, but I think I made them great opportunities, like starting the Department of Emergency Medicine in Brooklyn. That was not a great opportunity the day I became chair. But you look now, it's, I think, the largest EM residency in the country. It's a very, you know, a well-respected department. And the first day, I was the department. And so I'm really happy I had that opportunity.
How did that come about? What was the story?
The story is that EM didn't exist in Brooklyn. And there was popularity among the students. And so the dean got this guy, Dave Wagner, who was a pediatric surgeon, one of the original emergency physicians. He was chair at the Medical College of Pennsylvania, right now Drexel. So he was our consultant. And he met with me and I told him, you know, it's never going to happen. It's the politics are too complicated, blah, blah, blah. Well, unbeknownst to me, he goes to the dean and says, you should make a department. You should make Tom Scalia here. At the end of August in 91, Yankel Rosenbaum died in Brooklyn. And there was, right, a 1970 style race riot. The borough burned. And there was a huge amount of unrest. And he died because, largely because of inadequate care he got in the ED. So this is all over the newspaper. A 4-day spread in the New York Post. Just accusation after accusation. And I get a call from the dean. His secretary says, Dr. Wiener would like to see you. I go over, I walk in, and he says, you don't think I know who you are, do you? I said, no, sir, I didn't know you knew who I was. He goes, I know you're looking for a job. Yes, sir, that's true. He says, you don't like your chairman much, do you? No, sir, I don't. He said, well, you don't want to leave New York, so do you? No, sir, I don't. He said that I'm going to give you a great opportunity. I've just created the Department of Emergency Medicine in your chair. By the way, there's going to be a press conference with the mayor in 45 minutes. Did you bring a suit? And I said, no, sir. He goes, that's okay. I know where you live. It's right on the way.
Put
your car waiting for you outside. And he just looks down and starts working again. And he looks up to me and goes, why are you still standing here? And that's how I became chair.
That's awesome. So full disclosure, I got the chance to rotate at Shock Trauma in August. And that was one of the reasons that kind of like ultimately pushed me over, inspired me to pursue a career in critical care. But prior to that, I was also interested in international emergency medicine. And I always thought of how can you combine the two? And I know that you've had extensive international experience in China and Afghanistan and Haiti, among other places. So what has international critical care in these like low resource, low tech environments taught you about critical care in general that you could essentially bring here?
You can do a huge amount without many resources. I managed this one lady in florid heart failure in Haiti with a stethoscope, me giving her LASIK myself, and going back and re-examining her. And she had acute kidney injury, I thought. We had no labs. I had me and a stethoscope.
Mm-hmm.
She did great.
What intangibles can you have, I guess, in those situations? Like what extra or what things do you need or do you not need? You know, is it like do you need a heightened sense of your physical exam skills? Do you need, you know, like what?
When we were in China, we were in a very well-equipped hospital, but I have this, I just pulled some of those slides. There we are taping the x-rays up against the window. Mm-hmm. That's how we looked at chest x-rays. We didn't really use CT at all. Very, very rarely. And we did a ton with physical exam.
Mm-hmm. And
physical exam, you have to get good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, you guys were never trained to be good at it because you got a CT scan.
Mm-hmm.
But as scary as this may be, I actually practiced medicine before the days of CT scanning.
What?
Shockingly, not everybody died.
Okay.
And we really got very good at utilizing physical exams and regular x-rays and clinical judgment.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a pretty good way to take care of patients.
And just really quick, bouncing back, one question I have is somewhat related to leadership, somewhat related to your role as a physician in chief. One of the hardest things to do is to establish a culture in an organization. And Shock Trauma does have this really unique culture. Where do you think that comes from? How do you instill that kind of culture in, you know, this like hardworking, you know, we think we can handle anything that comes through the doors. You know, we can adapt to any kind of challenge. How do you create that?
I tried very hard when I first got here to not talk and to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Something I've gotten pretty good at. And I think if you listen to people, they will help. They have some great ideas if you just keep your mouth shut and let them talk. And I think that if you inspire people, if you show them that you will go out of your way for them, they will go out of their way for you.
Mm-hmm.
I have taken care of a relative for not every nurse in this hospital, but a whole bunch of, or a friend, and my answer is always the same. Hey, my father, yeah, I got this. Just give me the particulars. I'll take care of it for you. And they are very much beholden to me for being willing to serve. And then they in turn are willing and anxious to say, let's go. We can do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a sort of a mindset. You can instill it by going, yeah, we can get this done. We can absolutely get it. And we can.
Have there ever been any books or thinkers or I don't know, texts that you go to whenever you are trying to look for inspiration or motivation? Has there been ever in the past?
Yeah, when I came here, the guy that recruited me was Don Wilson. He was the dean. He wrote a book called Wilson's Way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's seven life lessons that he learned. And I use those all the time.
Okay. Could you share like one or two of them that yeah. might
put yourself in the other guy's shoes?
Mm-hmm.
Overperform.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty much you.
Don't complain.
Yeah. Huh. Have there been any failures in your life or career that have taught you something about resilience?
Yeah. When I was in Brooklyn, I was chief of trauma and chief of the ICU. And through a little bit of a convoluted story, I told my chairman that there was Dave Feliciano, who works with me now, was looking for a job. I said, we should make him chief of trauma. And he said, but that's your job. And I said, for Dave Feliciano, come on. He can have half of my job. Well, the next thing, Dave was looking for a chief of surgery job, not a chief of trauma job at that point. So I, you know, that went away. And the next thing I heard was Sal Scalfani, our IR guy, came in and said, why is Bernie advertising your job? I said, what are you talking about? Well, he decided he was going to hire somebody else to be chief. Mm-hmm. And I found out in the hall, which really was disappointing and really hurt my feelings. Mm-hmm. And so I really, I did some soul search and said, because I said, you know, hell with this. I'm going to quit. And I went back to, and I've told many people this. I said, what's important to me? Why am I here? And I said, this is my hospital. These are my patients, and I am not going to walk out. And I went up to the ICU, and we did some of the best work we had ever done. When we wrote the lactate papers, when we wrote the CABH paper, it's when we wrote the geriatric trauma paper. We innovated and we became a dominant force in critical care, trauma critical, because I said, I'm not going to walk away.
So, I mean, across your life, it almost makes sense how you got to where you were. I really wish we had so much. There's so much more we could actually talk about, hopefully, maybe one day. I always want to talk to you about the Abraham Lincoln study that you did. So I'm going to link to that in the show notes. Your relationship with Patch Adams, that's something else that hopefully one day we can talk about.
Yeah, no, that's Patches and I go back to 1976. Right?
Mm-hmm. If anyone out there wants to get in contact with you, is there anywhere on social media that they can reach out to you? Or
I am completely separated from social media, I am happy to say. Mm-hmm. Anybody that wants to find me can send me an email, tscalea@som.umaryland.edu. Or heaven forbid, they could call the office and ask to speak to me.
Whoa.
Crazy.
By voice, huh? Really good.
Wow.
But thank you so much for your time. This was really awesome.
My pleasure. Take care.
The former U.S. five-star general Douglas MacArthur once said, "A true leader has the confidence to stand alone, the courage to make tough decisions, and the compassion to listen to the needs of others. He does not set out to be a leader, but becomes one by the quality of his actions and the integrity of his intent." To learn more about the Dr. Hustle podcast, view past episodes, and to view today's show notes, visit our website at drhustle.com. And if you enjoyed the show, I also want to encourage you to look up the podcast on your respective platforms and leave a rating and review. It will help other people just like yourself find the Dr. Hustle community and help it grow. Don't forget to follow us on social media at dr.hustle on Instagram and dr_hustle on Twitter. And if you want to reach out to me personally, if you have guest recommendations or contacts, a desire to collaborate, or ways to improve the show, feel free to email me at hustle@drhustle.com. Once again, thank you so much for listening. It really means a lot.